going to talk a little bit about sleep here today. What are we going to do here today? Well, like all good things, NEI, Synapse, Congress, we're going to talk about some neurobiology. How does that sound at 8 in the morning? It is going to be so technical and so over your head. It's not just going to be the guy in the eighth row. It'll be somebody here. So no, we'll keep it light and easy. That video actually taught everything I need to do today. We could just quit. Anybody want to get some coffee? No? You guys already got coffee. Good. So not neurobiology. We got to do some. What else do we need to do? Screening tools. I'm going to teach about that right now. If you have a slide kit, I've actually hidden a bunch of slides because there's no way I can cover them all in 45 minutes. But I'm a big rating scale fan. Most of us probably use PHQ-9s and GAD-7s. If you find somebody really with sleep difficulty, well, there are a couple scales out there. So there's the Pittsburgh scale, which I like, and that kind of deals a bit more with your sleeping and sleeping hours and quality. During the daytime, you need next day consequences to have any kind of sleep disorder. You'll hear me harp on that a little bit. So the Epworth Sleepiness Scale, the Fatigue Severity Scale, there's a couple out there. So if you want to serial track this disorder of insomnia, let's say, or the target symptom of insomnia and fatigue and next day consequences, there are rating scales you can use. You know, happy to answer those questions later, talk to you outside, email me, and I'll show you the ones I use in practice. So I won't have a lot on screening instruments today, but they are there. There are apps on your phone. Sleep diaries are really important. They're not really scales, right? So there are many things you can do to use a rating scale approach to get better outcomes. And then at the end of the day, you know, we're going to talk neurobiology, and then based on the neurobiology, how do we treat people who can't sleep at night or are gosh darn tired all morning long? I'm going to teach to this slide. I'm going to come back to it. I have basically two key teaching slides today, and I really like this one. So if you kind of look straight up at the North Pole, the person there is, you know, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, paying attention, riveted to every single word I say this morning, right? Looking right at me, looking right at you. That's where we'd like to be, awake, alert, and cognitively doing great. And if we shift a little bit to one side, you'll see a blonde-haired gentleman with Z's coming out, looking really tired, bags under his eyes. That's being sleepy. We'll call that deficient arousal. And again, we don't want people sleepy like this during the daytime. Now, I don't know how many of you were an intern or a G1 or the equivalent in nursing school, but we used to have to round really early in the morning, like, you know, 5:30, we'd have to round before the senior resident would come in, and we'd have to wake all our patients up, which I always thought was horrible because the hospital is supposed to be a place for rest, right? And we had to get up early and do that. We'd round later in the day, 2-3 o'clock, our final rounds of the day. Patients would be awake. But did any of you ever have an experience? You'd go in and the highfalutin doctor comes in, that patient should look like the North Pole person here, bright eye looking at you. It's the most important part of the day when I roll into the room and you get the O sign. You know what the O sign is? Like the guy in the eighth row. No O signs out there today. And then the other, what's an even worse sign when you stroll in as the doctor, you know, the patient's supposed to be awake at 2-3 in the afternoon. What's the other one, the Q sign? You know, and people are sleepy and tired and mouth open, snoring, O sign, Q sign stuff. You're not supposed to be that way during the day. And again, certainly not during a lecture, not during your work day. Hopefully I'm not that boring where you all fall asleep, right? I guess if you're boring, that can happen. But there's something wrong if you're falling asleep on and off all day long. You don't have enough arousal to be awake and talk to me when I round on you at 3 in the afternoon. The flip side, go to the other side of the scale, and you'll notice excessive arousal. So it's, you know, you don't want to feel that way and agitated. Dr. Citrone talked about that yesterday. But go just a little bit. It's nighttime, and you're supposed to be able to turn everything off, get that restful sleep, and nope, can't do it. Got too many thoughts in my head, thinking about what's going to go wrong, replaying the day in my head. You got a little bit of arousal too much when you're supposed to be going to sleep. That's a problem. That probably drives insomnia. So our goal, and you're going to see me come back to this slide, is if you're too sleepy, not enough arousal, we want to give you some arousal, medication-wise. And again, if you're too aroused at night, we want to dampen it and bring you back to the middle. The brain likes to be in the middle. So we're going to refer back to this chart a lot throughout my talk today. So now I do have to do some neurobiology things. Are you ready for it? I don't know if this looks familiar to folks in the audience, but look at the blue diagram on the top. So this is the ultridian or the sleep cycle. So when you go to sleep and you close your eyes, your brain actually has a pacemaker. It's almost like a circadian clock within a circadian clock. Your brain's pretty active at night, doing things up, down, left, right. And I want to share that with you because it's complicated, right? And you should understand that sleep is complicated. So notice the top of the blue diagram. You're awake. You skip through dream sleep or REM sleep. And you go into stage one or two. That's light sleep. And then you cascade into deep sleep, stage three and four. Slow wave sleep, delta wave sleep. What happens there? That's your really great, deep, restorative sleep. Any of you know what that's like anymore? Can I share a story with you about how you know if you've had good deep sleep? So I don't know if any of you have kids. My kids are 17, 20, and 22, so they're older, but remember when they were two or three and how cute they were, and they always listened to everything I said? Yeah. Well, what happens in Syracuse, New York, snow belt capital of the world, we might want to take the family to the in-laws live in Rochester, another snow belt city. But you know how what you got to do? You got to get your two or three-year-old all bundled up in five layers of clothes. So they put the winter coat on and they look like this. Remember that movie growing up? Yeah, and then they have to sit in the back of the minivan in that 48-point harness that they all sit in now so they stay safe. And then you drive to grandma and grandpa's house, and you come back at 10 at night. None of my kids were good sleepers, right, falling asleep-wise. So what did we need to do? So Dr. Schwartz had to pretend he was Navy SEAL Schwartz, and I'd have to get out of the minivan, open the door, and then stealthily sneak to the back of the minivan where toddler Schwartz was, right? Way in the back. Remember the movie The Shining? The hallway that was so long, that's the minivan thing. Kids dead asleep in the back, you know, in the 48-point harness. And you gotta get back there and unbuckle everyone without making a click, right? And then you get your kid out, you put him over your back, you stealthily Navy SEAL Schwartz, come out. Minivan door open, you jump out like paratrooper, boom. Kid whacks his head on top of the minivan. It's okay. And then you creep in the house, you hold your kid out. Mr. Schwartz pulls all the gloves, boots, throws them around, dogs barking. What's my kid doing? Awesome. Dog barking, head whacking, boot throwing, doesn't wake up. That's deep sleep. Didn't any of you sleep that way last night? Man, that's awesome. So that's deep sleep. That's restorative sleep. There's nothing going to wake you up, and you need that. You get most of that in the early part of your night. So if you're on call like me and you get called at 1 in the morning, what did my resident do? They interrupted my deep 48 harness sleep, right? So that's where you get your deepest restorative sleep. So it's important to be able to fall asleep and get to sleep and get into that. Now, when we're in stage 4 deep sleep, being restored, notice what happens. We go back up to light sleep and then REM or dream sleep. That's one sleep cycle, 60, 90 minutes for most people. And we do it again and again and again. Light sleep, deep sleep, light sleep, dream. Light sleep, deep sleep, light sleep, dream. Notice your dream sleep, REM gets bigger and bigger towards the morning. So when my alarm goes off at 5:30, it's going to interrupt my best dreaming cycle too, right? So there's this shift from restorative sleep to dreaming sleep, and you have these cycles, and you scratch your head. How does the brain know to do light sleep, deep sleep? And we're going to share that with you too, of course, right? There's lots of those neurotransmitters we've all learned to love here at NAI events that we're going to talk about how it drives this cycle. And then looking at the bottom diagram, I don't know if any of you are competitive. I'm not competitive at all, right? We're going to get 100 today. So we got the opponent process model. There's two teams fighting with you every day. This is a daytime diagram. And what you'll notice in blue is the homeostatic sleep drive. Notice from 7 a.m. onwards, it gets bigger and bigger. This is the drive that's pushing you to go to sleep inappropriately during the day. You're burning ATP, adenosine's building up, it gets eye level, it's 11 p.m., go to sleep, right? So your brain keeps track and wants you to go to sleep by your bedtime. So we don't fall asleep during the day. I've been joking about the gentleman in row 8, he's not sleeping. What happens? We're all awake. How do you get to stay awake even at 4 o'clock this afternoon after sitting here all day? The orange team comes off the bench, right? They're the wakefulness team, the circadian wakefulness team, norepinephrine, dopamine. We're going to talk about these players in a minute. But they're fighting. They're like, stay awake, keep the eyes open, keep the brain firing. So we got adenosine pushing you to sleep. You got the monoamines pushing you up, and they meet in the middle perfectly. And we never fall asleep during the day. Now, at nighttime, what do you want to see happen around 11 o'clock? This person's bedtime. You want adenosine to win, lots of pressure. That should be the winning team at night, and your orange team should knock it off. Norepinephrine, dopamine, et cetera, should calm down and let you drift into sleep. And you start the whole thing over. It's complicated. You've got multiple processes with moving variables and targets trying to get you to sleep appropriately and be awake. Now, if there's ever a shift, left or right, you get jet lag or circadian shift disorder, sleep disorder. And what if the amplitude changes for any of these parties? One gets weaker or stronger. You might not be asleep at the right time or awake at the right time. So just to give you the backdrop of what the heck is going on in your brain, it ain't so simple. Most of us get in bed and we let it happen and you fall asleep. But your brain is doing some complicated stuff. So here's where the video, the awesome focuser video, already taught you some of this. So notice the sun is out. How do we stay awake? We have a very stimulating chemical called acetylcholine. Acetylcholine, mostly from the basal forebrain, runs up into your cortex and starts turning on the lights inside your brain, right? We need more electricity. We need to be more awake. So acetylcholine is a wakefulness arousal chemical. We need that to be awake during the day. Next player, dopamine, you saw in the video. Dopamine from the ventral tegmental area. Again, parallel pathway. We have two pathways wanting you to be appropriately awake during the day. So dopamine helps out. Guess who? Norepi from the locus coeruleus. We have three pathways to keep us gosh darn awake during Dr. Schwartz's lecture, right? And what else do we got? Serotonin, almost a parallel pathway. Serotonin goes to some other brain areas, kicks them in the gear, activating pathways to keep us awake. Now, I've only listed three on this diagram. Bear with me a minute. Any of you heard of histamine? So for histamine, we usually think about making you tired because that's antihistamine, blocking the histamine 1 receptor. What if we promote histamine? Parallel pathway runs up to the cortex. We are now up to 4 people, 4 pathways keeping you awake. Anybody heard of the orexin pathway? We're going to talk about that today too. Orexin is kind of, I call it the backup generator. If one of my 4 pathways flutters and drops, orexin gives it a puff of energy and kicks it back online. So I view the orexin as the backup generator. It kind of has these tentacles that kind of reaches into all these other wakefulness areas here. You know, sometimes you know what I like to call it? The Kraken. So when you're falling asleep, I see anybody fall asleep, a woman in the 12th row, I'm going to go, release the Kraken. Get your orexin going and you're going to wake up. You know, the other thing I forgot to mention, do you know how else? No, I'll save that one for later. You're going to have to wait for that one. I got another idea of how to wake people up, but that's coming later. But we got 4, 5, 6 pathways to keep you awake. That's how important it is to be awake and have good executive functioning during the day, right? So on that level, let's switch gears. Look at what happened on my slide behind me. Notice the moon there? Anybody upset with the picture of the moon? I think NEI has to fire their astronomer. Anybody know why? Yeah, so my father-in-law, retired earth science teacher, amateur astronomer, would be livid in the back pacing around right now. So what's wrong with the star in the middle of the moon? It cannot be there. Even though it's a third of a moon, what's a whole moon? It's a solid object. Do any of you know of any stars between the Earth and the moon? Stars are all behind the moon. The moon is a solid object, even when we can't see it. The star has to be moved outside the circumference. So you didn't know you were here for an astronomy lecture today, right? All right, so that's the one problem with the slide here, but here's the good part of the slide. Notice the purple ventrolateral preoptic area, pinpoint size, sleep center. One ring to control them all. Anybody know that reference? Like Lord of the Rings stuff? Yeah, it takes like 6 things to be awake during the day, but at night, what do you need? You need one little switch to go on. And it has its own tentacles. I don't call this one the Kraken because that'll be too confusing. But it turns off all those wakefulness centers. Light goes out, suprachiasmatic says it's nighttime, right? Tuberous mammary nucleus is hanging out there. It goes off, but the VLPO switches on. On is good. That's the sleep promoting center. GABA goes out, turns everybody else off in a cascade. You drift into sleep, and it's great. So the sleep circuit's actually pretty simple. So going to sleep should be easy. So remember I talked about your sleep cycles, light sleep, deep sleep, dream sleep. Remember back when we did that a long time ago? So how does that work? Well, when you go to bed, you want that VLPO to put your GABA and GALN up and start dampening things. We want things to be inhibited and shut off. That orexin chemical, what was orexin? Release the Kraken, yeah. Starts shutting off as well. We don't want the backup generator on. It runs out of fuel, so we don't want people being able to kick into extra gear. And look at that. So we have something called acetylcholine here that's stimulating, so when it drops, you get in a deep sleep, and when it peaks, it kicks you into REM or dream sleep. So everybody on video, I want you to get this right. Don't tell people here, acetylcholine triggers REM. It peaks during REM, right? So remember, folks, acetylcholine peaks, kicking you into not only light sleep, but into your dreaming sleep. It peaks during REM. Can you say that with me? Peaks during REM. Making things more complicated, your other monoamines do play ball. They get lower to make sure you stay in deep sleep. But again, how do you get out of light sleep? You need a little puff of norepi. Not a big puff like acetylcholine, which peaks during REM. All right, enough being funny. All right, so how do we get down to business? Now that you know the neurobiology, the chemicals are listed here. If you want to wake somebody up, lower the sedating inhibitory chemical GABA. We don't have anything that does that. Look at all the things we can do to make the brain more stimulated. Look at all those chemicals, right? And then nighttime's the reverse. We might want to promote GABA, but we want to lower the stimulatory chemicals, and we have lots of drugs that can do that. So this is an impact slide. I removed a bunch of them, and I'm supposed to say, why is insomnia bad? Why is sleep deprivation bad, wherever it comes from? There are lots of downstream negative consequences. One here is we do disrupt feeding, hormonal balance between leptin and ghrelin. People gain weight and have medical comorbidities. We could show you data on third shift workers who are shift deprived, circadian rhythm sleep disorder, that have more cancers, heart disease, and stroke. So missing your sleep all the time is bad for you medically and certainly psychiatrically, which is where we're gonna go next. All right, remember this. So remember what I said about being slightly aroused when you try to go to bed. You know, how many imagine you're laying there, eyes are open, you can't go to sleep, and Dr. Schwartz yells at you? I stole that from Dr. Stahl. I've seen that technique from him. You should not leave NEI having PTSD from a speaker. So I'm sorry I yelled at you, but you're all awake, right? Maybe too awake. But the idea is imagine you're going to bed and you just have that feeling, right? And you can't fall asleep, your thoughts are racing. So that's what we think happens in insomnia. What is insomnia? The recurrent inability to fall asleep, stay asleep, maintain sleep, or maybe you get enough hours, but then you wake up tired and dysfunctional. You have to have next day consequences. All of us miss some sleep every now and then. But recurring of missing sleeps with problems functioning the next day, you now have a disorder. Insomnia, looking chronically back, is a bad signal. You know, some people lose sleep and cascade into mania. It's a harbinger of bad things to come next week. But what if you've had insomnia for a few years as your only problem? Unfortunately, look downstream from that. These folks have a lot more depression development, anxiety development, addiction problems. Insomnia is horrible. I mean, I believe many of you have talked to your patients about their experience of insomnia, right? You're alone, it's dark, there's no support, and it's a horrible feeling, the fear of not being able to go to sleep. We have some movie stars, and we have some musical stars like Michael Jackson and propofol, died because of insomnia. That's how scared he was. Heath Ledger, a couple Percocets, a couple Ambiens, glass of wine, cereal, couldn't fall asleep, movie star. So it can be that terrifying that people self-medicate and then get themselves addicted, and that may actually kill them more than the insomnia ever will. Very terrifying place to be for some people and an independent risk factor for suicide. So whenever we see insomnia, hopefully what you get from the treatment part of today's lecture, we can be much more aggressive in treating it. We don't split hairs anymore. If your depression is due to major depressive disorder, we used to call that secondary. You know, you're a second class citizen, you're not really, you know, insomnia yet. Now, it is now. It's a standalone disorder. If it is a focus of your attention, you label major depressive disorder in your EMR, and you also label insomnia. You're treating both. It increases the complexity, and you can use 992 and 4 now. Two problems, two sets of meds, right? More risks. You put those in your little billing blurb at the end, right? Your case just got much more complicated with an independent risk factor for suicide. So we're allowed to bill that way. We're treating multiple things. But look, as insomnia, regardless of where it comes from, is a standalone problem that you can address. I'm going to jump around a little bit. We'll start talking about treatment here. What could you do? You could start with melatonin. Your brain makes it all your own melatonin, right? Lights go out, super chiasmatic, says it's nighttime. Your pineal gland starts flicking out melatonin. So your regular melatonin may not be enough. Over-the-counter melatonin, 3 to 10 milligrams, hour before bed, empty stomach's better, absorbs better. But melatonin can get to the MT1 receptor, which is that norepinephrine dopamine team that fights to keep you awake. It turns them down. You can also send melatonin to the MT2 receptor, which takes your circadian clock at the suprachiasmatic and says, stay on the 24. 24 is good. Keep going 24. And I don't know what the MT3 does, but it's good to get more melatonin there. If you want to use a prescription, they're listed there. Remeltion and Tasimeltion for insomnia and non-24. So we have drugs that go after melatonin activity and turn it up, right? And that kind of dampens arousal, which is a good thing. So you could try to reset circadian rhythms with some initial intervention like that. And then what else can we do? We have that alert person. I won't yell at you. So I had it planned where every time the slide, it was tipped to that side, I was going to yell at you, but I'm only going to do it once today. You're all awake now. But what can you do? You increase GABA. We have true benzos. We have BZRAs. You increase GABA, more inhibition, push people towards getting asleep. We can block histamine 1, right? We have antihistamines. We can do other stuff. You can dampen norepi, not on the slide. How do you do that? Off-label blood pressure pills, prazosin, clonidine, guanfacine, lower some norepinephrine. Not a bad thing. We can do stuff like that. What happens when you block serotonin 2A? Who does that? Nifazidone, trazodone, mirtazapine, the sedating antidepressants. Sedation's good off-label for getting people to sleep sometimes. Who else does it? The atypical or second generation antipsychotics, they all do it, because that's how we lower EPS. But what does serotonin 2A get you in the world of sleep? It doesn't get you tired. But let's say if the antihistamine removes some arousal, one of those pathways, and you drift into sleep, serotonin 2A pushes you to that deep sleep, stage 4. Increases sleep efficiency. So remember that cycle I showed you at nighttime, the blue diagram. Serotonin 2A helps you get into deep sleep, while all our antidepressants, no, most of them destroy that deep sleep, actually. So it's not a bad drug to add off-label if you can block serotonin 2A. So there are lots of ways to remove arousal and get you better sleep. And here they are. This is the second teaching slide I wanted to go through today. Wanted to tell a couple stories, joke about people in different rows, and teach two slides, right? So here's everything you need to know. So in the green, you have the true benzodiazepines. GABA-A receptor with GABA bound to it, benzo floats in, chloride channel is ecstatic, opens up more. Get more chloride to come in, you inhibit neuronal firing, and parts of your brain go to sleep. The one ring to control them all story. So you can use the true benzos, right? Addiction risk, psychomotor impairment, respiratory suppression. So they carry with them some problems. So folks have invented the non-benzos. These are the BZRAs. They're benzo-like. Sometimes we call them non-benzo-benzos. But they still do that GABA-A thing. Their half-lives are really short, so they tend to get in and get out. So there still is psychomotor impairment, but less. There still is addiction, but probably less. Yeah. Respiratory suppression, yeah, probably less. But still all there to contend with. The short half-life and more rapid absorption gets you what? Amnesia. All those blackout parasomnias. Sleep talking, sleep walking, sleep driving, sleep having sex, sleep going to work and doing your job and coming back home even though it's midnight. I've seen all these things happen and people don't remember them. So you do get that extra kind of parasomnia labeling from these. So they're pretty good. All these drugs hit GABA, elevate GABA activity. People go to sleep. So you can increase sedation at night. Further down in kind of pink, you have doxepin. Doxepin at 7,500, 50, 300 milligrams is a tricyclic antidepressant. Levels, EKGs, QTC prolongation. But when you use 3 to 6 milligrams, just a little bit, what do you get? A really good sleeping pill that's FDA approved. All antihistamine, not tricyclic. No levels needed, no EKG problems. Data in geriatric patients and non-geriatric patients. So doxepin's FDA approved as an antihistamine. Trazodone's below it off-label. I'd put mifepristone or mirtazapine in there off-label, similar approaches. Then we have the antipsychotics. I often will say, how many of you use one of these for sleep? And hopefully no hands go up. If you're using an atypical antipsychotic for bipolarity, major depression disorder, where they're FDA approved, and they happen to make your patient sleepy and go to bed, that's awesome. But as a freestanding sleeping pill, you have antihistamine, anti-alpha-1 for norepinephrine, serotonin 2A, everything you get from trazodone. Why would you want to open the can of worms of TD and metabolic disorder just to get somebody to sleep? Now, at bigger doses, you block some dopamine, which is a good thing. You block some dopamine, and that can dampen arousal, and maybe you get that mechanism at the bigger doses. But the little doses we use, you're not getting that. So I'm kind of negative on the atypicals as solo treatments for insomnia. There's so many better, safer things to do. The hypocretins in purple, we're going to talk about the orexin antagonist in a minute, so we'll skip those. We talked about melatonin. What else can you do? You can use the anxiolytic benzos if you like. I like to use the ones listed here because they hit that benzo 1 receptor in the sleep center a bit better, and you get more sleepy more quickly. We can use the calcium channel blocking epilepsy medicines, gabapentin and pregabalin. There's data showing they improve slow wave sleep too. They're a little sedating, you drift into sleep, and they push you into that deeper restorative sleep, right? So sometimes we get away with off-label use of the calcium channel blocking epilepsy meds. We don't use tiagabine anymore. It's a GABA reuptake inhibitor. It tends to induce seizures in non-epilepsy patients. So we kind of don't use that one anymore. Antihistamine, diphenhydramine, chlorpheniramine, doxylamine, over-the-counter stuff. Most of your patients have tried them. They do work. You can tell people to try over-the-counter things. And prescription anxiolytic antihistamine hydroxyzine can be used. You're cutting off histamine arousal, remove arousal, people get more sleepy. You can combine these in rational polypharmacy for really refractory cases if you need to. So this is the playing field. So when I yell at you to wake you up, right, feeling hyper aroused, and if it's nighttime and you can't sleep, how do we push people to the middle? That's this table for you. If you have specific questions, please put them in the Q&A. So let's talk about the DORAs, dual orexin antagonists, a little bit here. So remember, release the Kraken, right? We have orexin keeping everybody else firing on all cylinders. That keeps you awake. I don't want that happening at night. So what if I block your receptors, orexin 1 and 2? I block those receptors, and what they typically do when they're activated is give you more calcium stimulation and give you more NMDA glutamate stimulation in the brain. So if I block orexin activity, I block two stimulating things downstream, I remove arousal, two different ways, and you get sleepy, you go to sleep. So that's how the DORAs do work. Here's the Kraken diagram. Look at LH, the box in the middle, and how it reaches out to all those other wakefulness centers. What if we cut all those off? And we say, we're not gonna let you be awake after 11 p.m. at night. So you can use a sleeping pill that now blocks orexin at two different receptors. Here's the three of them in the family. I won't teach much about suvorexant. We have the past couple of years here. It's been available longer. Lemborexant came out a couple of years ago, and the most recent one was deridorexant. And what you'll see, similar to other sleeping pills, we got three drugs in class. You have three options. They tend to have different pharmacokinetics or half-lives, right? So do you want a longer-acting drug, a shorter-acting drug, more daytime hangover, less daytime hangover, et cetera? So you have some options now, which I think makes life interesting in the world of the DORAs. If you get side effects on one, you have other choices. Try another one. So it's kind of nice to have multiple drugs in class now, and it gives you different options. So again, let me go through the second released one, lemborexant. How do you dose it? 5 or 10 milligrams with most of our sleeping pill. try to use the lower doses first. If not, use the full dose range. Treating insomnia is at least a 40% placebo effect in almost everything we do. Try to use the lower doses. If not, you can certainly go up to 10. And then the new one is listed here, dry direction. Half-life quite a bit shorter. As we mentioned, dosing is 25 or 50. And on this one, what I liked in some of their studies, it's how many more hours of sleep can you get? That's how you treat insomnia. And how do you function? Right? Remember, for insomnia, you need recurring bad sleep, inability to sleep, and next day function problems. So let's study both, right? So I really liked some of their work here. So you get better sleep and your functioning comes back to you, which was nice to see. Here's an exploratory experimental one in phase three. It's a single, it's a SORA, not a DORA. We'll see if this one comes out. So there's some other drugs under investigation. What else can you do to get people to go sleep? Sleep hygiene, sleep hygiene, sleep hygiene. Some of you rolled your eyes when I said that, right? That's what my patients do. Here's a handout. I'd like you to try five or six of these 20 things that improve your sleep behaviorally. That ain't gonna work, Dr. Schwartz, but it does work. And before you write any prescription, I advise you hand somebody one of these and say, try three or four of them for a week. If it doesn't work, add three or four more behavioral changes. And I'll see you in 4 weeks. If you're really not sleeping and you really try, I will write you a prescription. It's really great in your notes to say, gave patient informed consent about multiple sleeping pills and sleep hygiene. And I strongly advise them to try sleep hygiene first. Now they can refuse. This is America. You can refuse treatments, right? But at least you tried to do the safest thing first. And I don't know, one out of 20, one out of 30 people actually get a bit better with their sleep just by giving them a handout. Right? So try sleep hygiene. When we talk about hypersomnia, that's being sleepy all day, there's wakefulness hygiene too. Behavior activation, get up, do a little exercise, get the lights on. So there's actually wake hygiene protocols as well. And CBT, CBT, CBT. So remember that big pharmacology chart where I showed you all the things that I've done with my patients? When all of those have failed, I have a great CBT therapist down the hall. And I send the patient down there and I go, I've thrown a kitchen sink at this problem. I can't fix insomnia. She does 12 weeks of CBTI, and I have at least five or six saves where CBT beat my med approach. So I'm a really big believer in CBT. So if you have the ability to refer to a CBT therapist, you might want to do that before you prescribe too. So we have some non-pharmacology things that are pretty effective. All right, so now I am going to switch gears, and we're going to talk about the O and the Q sign. You remember that? If I wanted to wake you up, I would make you all do the O sign and the Q sign back at me, but you're a socially anxious group, so I won't make you do that this morning. All right, so I can't stress enough, when somebody is sleeping inappropriately during the day, and this is me triples, medical, right? So obstructive sleep apnea. When you snore and you wake yourself up because you're not oxygenating at night 30 times, 100 times, you never get that deep sleep. When you have restless legs and you have to get up 8, 9, 10 times to kind of walk around, that's lower body akathisia, right? You got to get the squirmy, fidgety legs, Jimmy legs out of you. And then you go back to bed, 10 minutes later, you got to do it again. You lost a couple hours of sleep. Anybody know about myoclonic legs? It's when you karate chop your spouse or your bed partner all night long. You wake them up, you micro-awake, but they're mad at you and they're black and blue in the morning, but your legs have that spastic, and it's enough to wake you up. So a lot of these medical things, neuropathy from diabetes, et cetera, your legs are painful, you gotta move the sheets around 20, 30. You're not getting that deep sleep. Remember I showed you that parachute out of the minivan, bumped the head on the head thing with the kid and he's still asleep? You get none of that if your medical conditions wake you up all the time. So I think in psychiatry, you have to get good at some of those medical conditions. I can't teach them all today. I'm gonna teach two, and maybe one is the primary one. But ask about those things, get a letter off to the primary care. Hey, have you noticed any medical problems that might interfere with sleep if you're not good at it? So on that level, medical. We give drugs that make people tired. You're all aware of those. People might be addicted to things. And certainly is that their depression making them tired. We're good at that stuff. But don't forget, medical. Big cause of fatigue. So what I'm gonna talk about, other side of the stage, and other side of the slide, mostly idiopathic hypersomnia. The audience, you don't see a ton of narcolepsy. I'm going to spend a little bit of time on it. I do think you should understand narcolepsy because a lot of patients walk in and they tell you they have it and they really have hypersomnia, which we'll get to. So again, now you're shifted towards sleepy too much during the daytime. Idiopathic hypersomnia is the foil of insomnia. Recurring daytime sleepiness, tired, fatigued, falling asleep at inappropriate times, leading to next day consequences or dysfunction. And this is, people are tired. They feel like they missed their cup of coffee. They're missing 20, 30% of their energy. They drift off into sleep. Even if it's a riveting lecture, boring lectures you can, but riveting lectures, you should never fall asleep. This is a problem, right? How do you retain information, remember things, functioning of the job? Like, you're never gonna be able to get the things done that you need to get done. And people around you notice you lose your jobs, lower self-esteem. So this can be a problem. And it's pervasive, it's an everyday thing. Narcolepsy, most of the narcolepsy patients I've seen don't see it coming, right? So they're minding their own business and then boom, they're out. They go into instant REM. So you have instant sleep attacks. Cataplexy, or the loss of muscle tone, usually around an emotional feeling, anger, surprise, joy, can trigger this. They have sleep paralysis, hypnagogic, and pompic hallucinations. There's this kind of series of things they get, but my average narcolepsy patient doesn't know it's gonna hit. My average idiopathic hypersomnia one, yeah, I'm 20% tired all the time, but I feel 30, 40. Yeah, I'm gonna make it to the couch to lay down. So it's not a seizure spell, it's not a fainting syncopal spell, it's not a narcolepsy attack. So they're a little different in their cadence is what I've noticed. So narcolepsy has more of an immediate effect. And so switching back to hypersomnia, what if they're jet lag, circadian shifted? They go to bed too early, wake up too early, or the opposite. We're pretty good. I gave you that whole chart. I made you suffer through neurobiology to do what? Knock people out at the right time and wake them up at the right time. So we have sleeping chemicals and wakefulness chemicals. You strategically put them where you need them. Get somebody back to like a midnight, 9 a.m. kind of cycle or something like that. You have lots of drugs to do that. I'm from the snowbelt capital of the world. Cloudier than Seattle, snowier than almost every place in United States. We have a lot of seasonal depression. We dish out white boxes like candy where I live, right? 10,000 lux, 30 minutes a day. I mean, I know this by heart for treating seasonal depression, but actually can help hypersomnia patients. You have to be able to get up, maybe use a dawn simulator, put the thing on a timer for 7 a.m. or something like that. But you do need to be awake and your eyes need to be open or it doesn't work. So you have some non-pharmacologic things you can do. What can we do pharmacologically? There's another table. These are all the wake you up kind of chemicals that are out there for us. So again, many of us know how to increase dopamine, norepinephrine, et cetera. So how does histamine work? Well, our modafinil. Modafinil increases histamine activity, orexin activity, dopamine activity, and norepi. All a little bit. It's a multifactorial drug, modafinil and armodafinil, and then is approved for narcolepsy, shift work sleep disorder, and obstructive apnea fatigue. So the stimulants, what do? They block norepinephrine reuptake. So you get the norepinephrine stuff. Remember that pathway? From all of them. And then the methylphenidates block the dopamine transporter, so you get more dopamine. What do the amphetamines do? They block it, reverse it, and give you vesicular release. Three types of dopamine activity from an amphetamine. Remember, I think we heard from Dr. Goodman that some people in ADHD respond to one or not the other. It's because they're a little different in how they manage dopamine. So you may find this when you're trying to make somebody more wakeful. So here's a drug that's out too. It's an NDRI. We're used to bupropion, right, treating depression. Well, we have a bupropion-like drug that can treat wakefulness problems. So you have this agent that you can add. This one carries a C4 controlled drug, I believe, and Wellbutrin bupropion off-label does not. Don't want to use it too late, or you can get people up too late, just like bupropion. So if you're comfortable with the drug we use for depression and seasonal depression and smoking cessation, this drug handles pretty similarly, and it's on label for excessive daytime sleepiness due to narcolepsy and apnea. Pitolisant's interesting. So histamine, H3. Any of you heard of H3 before? You heard me preaching about H1, right? But H3 is interesting. It's an autoreceptor, and if it fires, it dampens histamine, puts the brakes on, you know, so that makes people tired. So if you block the dampener, then it's free rein on histamine, right? You increase histamine firing, which wakes you up in one of those parallel pathways. So pitolisant is a drug that can be used for wakefulness. And then I'll end up with the sodium oxybate type group, I think, here today for the most part. So GHB, gamma hydroxybutyrate, is a bathtub-made chemical that's used illegally by bodybuilders because it gives you great, deep, slow-wave sleep. And when you have slow-wave sleep, growth factors go up, you get bigger muscles. It's also used by nefarious folks because it's a liquid. It could be a date rape product. When you make pharmaceutical-grade control through REMS and distribution, sodium oxybate's been FDA-approved for narcolepsy for a long time. And it's because you get so much deep sleep at night, you agonize the GABA-B receptor, more so than the A receptor, which makes it unique, that you don't have as many sleep attacks the next day because you got such great deep sleep. It's a very unique product. And so that's Xyrem and how it works. Newer version of that is a mixture of sodium oxybate, potassium, magnesium, and calcium. So it's a little bit of, it's like blended whiskey, right? So you got a little bit of a different taste to it, but again, FDA approved for hypersomnia, where the other one was approved for narcolepsy. So we have two similar drugs in class. They are looking to make a once nightly prep, because usually you have to put two shot glasses on your nightstand, take one and go to sleep, wake up 4 hours later, take the other. It'd be nice to have just one shot glass on your nightstand. And that wraps up all the drugs we're gonna talk about today. So what do you need to know? There's always neurobiology behind the prescriptions we do, and now you understand a little bit of why we throw different medicines at different problems. We also teach about FDA approvals, right? So if you don't care about neurobiology, at least know what the FDA has approved and what's been studied to treat the different conditions. Know a little bit about the off-label approaches that are scientifically sound and make neurobiological sense. And then you can treat insomnia and you can treat hypersomnia. And that was really the goal of today.